From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. We're continuing our series of conversations with speakers from the Naples Discussion Group's 2021 schedule today by talking with Dr. William Felice. He's professor of political science at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg. We're getting a bit of a preview of his talk titled The Ethical Dimensions to International Relations and American Foreign Policy. The Naples Discussion Group lectures are not open to the public this year due to COVID restrictions. Dr. Felice is the author of 6 books, including Introduction to International Politics, Global Challenges and Policy Responses, Taking Suffering Seriously, The Ethics of Interdependence, Global Human Rights and Duties, and How Do I Save My Honor? I spoke with Professor Felice yesterday afternoon by phone. Let's hear that now. Dr. William Felice is professor of political science at Eckerd College. Dr. Felice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Our conversation is pre-recorded, but you can engage with us and fellow listeners by finding us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So let's just start with some basic first principles here. How far back does the idea of human rights on the international level go?
I think that the idea of human rights goes back a long ways. But for the purposes of today, I think the key date is 1945 and the founding of the United Nations in 1948, the passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Prior to that, there had been talk of human rights, but it really became codified in international law following the Holocaust and the 6 million Jews that were killed and the 5 million others that were killed in World War II, that this brutality, this genocide, these crimes against humanity shocked really the conscience of the world. And so the global community drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, defining in 30 short articles what are basic principles that are really to serve as sort of ethical guidelines of moral duties across borders, across politics, that all individuals should be treated this way, irregardless of where they're born, what class they're in, what race they are. So I would date it from there, and that just one prior historical example I'd give you to show the difference would be the Armenian genocide at the beginning of the 20th century, at the beginning of World War One, just prior to World War One, at the turn of the 20th century, and over 1 million Armenians were killed in that time, but there was no global regime of human rights to even speak out. Really, the Christian community was alarmed because Christians getting killed. But the American ambassador to Armenia at the time, his name is Morgenthau, he cabled home and said, unfortunately, according to the cold-blooded reality of the situation, the treatment of Turkish citizens by the Turkish government is an internal affair. That there was no international human rights or no global human rights. It was an internal affair. Well, Hitler really changed the world's understanding of that, that no longer was genocide and crimes against humanity solely an internal affair. That with the founding of the United Nations, that the world community said, international peace and security depends upon paying attention to the violations of human rights inside of borders and not ignoring them. And so the real change did come with the founding of the United Nations.
When the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed, was there any pushback or was the world unified at that point?
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed. I don't have the total in front of me, but it was passed unanimously with, I think it was around 7 abstentions, and nobody voted no. And so it was, and one of the things that's interesting, Eleanor Roosevelt, our first lady at the time, Franklin Roosevelt's wife, she chaired the Human Rights Commission that drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And she did, not just her, but she and the committee did something pretty amazing. It's probably the only time in human history, well, that's probably going too strong a statement, but one of the few times when you have this global conversation between Christians and Jews and Muslims and liberal secularists and international law folks and people from Confucianist ideologies from Asia and North America and Latin America engaged in this amazing dialogue on, well, what are human rights? What should we codify? What should we write down? And so it was not just a Western project. There's this image that's often projected that human rights as defined in the international system today are Western and just a product of Western imperialism. And I really want to push back on that because this dialogue was global and it brought in, as I've already listed, the different religions and philosophies and perspectives and produced really a corpus of rights that we can really build on and have served now for over 50 years as a foundation for ethical guidance for foreign policy making.
You could probably write a whole book on this, and you may have, but how effective has this Universal Declaration of Human Rights been in the world since its passage in 1948?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things I would say is that I think you need to break it down into norm creation and standard setting. And then I talk about a human rights system. And the human rights system has three components. One is norm creation and standard setting. And second are the human rights institutions to monitor compliance with these norms. And then third would be enforcement mechanisms. And so if we look at each of these individually, in terms of norm creation and standard setting, I think you have to view the United Nations project around human rights as a huge success. That not only do we have the Universal Declaration, but we have treaties that followed up that declaration. So there's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, treaties on the protection of women, conventions against torture, conventions on the rights of the child, protection of refugees, and on and on and on. It's a huge web of rights that nations, if they sign on, and the vast majority of the states have ratified these treaties, they are expected to follow through on their word. So then you have to move to the institutions. And so the institutions are set up to monitor state compliance. And there's not time today in our brief interview to go through them, but I would just say that with the reforms of the Human Rights Council in Geneva and the Universal Periodic Review, every state is monitored. Every state has to report, and the UN engages in what's called constructive dialogue with these states to try to get them to change their policies. And surprisingly, it is effective in many cases. States want to be seen as human rights protectors. No state, even when they're violating human rights, wants to be held up as a human rights violator. And so you have states going back and changing their laws on discrimination, changing their policies that were hurting children, changing their policies, for example, the discrimination against gypsies in Eastern Europe, that through pressures of the UN, many of those laws were changed. And so you do see positive results from this dialogue. But then the third part of the system, the enforcement mechanism, and I think this is what you perhaps in your question might be getting at, is we look around the world and we see huge violations of human rights and nothing is being done. And I think that's right. I mean, this is, yes, we've had the successes that I mentioned, but we shouldn't try to pretend that that this system has helped in many cases protect human rights. Today we have genocide occurring in Myanmar and in China. The Uyghur peoples that are being killed there. We have Saudi Arabia, of course, that continues to violate human rights on a massive scale. And the press, of course, the slaughter of Jamal Khashoggi, bringing that to a head and on and on. And so we have a long way to go, absolutely. But I think the bones of the structure are valid. They're strong. And they provide a way to address, hopefully, some of these egregious violations.
The talk you're giving is going to be called The Ethical Dimensions to International Relations and American Foreign Policy. And in the summary you sent me, you said that the question is often posed as to how a nation balances national interest with its values. And my first question is, you know, how has the way this question has been answered by the United States varied over the course of history?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that for the United States, we have too often pitted the two against each other. So our interests always take priority over our values. You know, in ethics, you know, what is, you know, ethics is, you know, study of right and wrong conduct. You know, how do you apply principles that pursue the values you believe in? And at the individual level, it's often very clear you don't lie, cheat, steal, kill, and so on. But as you move up to the nation state level, it gets harder to apply those values to a state and to state's foreign policy. The lens of human rights is a framework, I think, to do that. And you ask about the history of the United States. I think that, unfortunately, what we've seen is a certain hypocrisy around human rights and a politicization of human rights and a double standard in our practice of human rights. So if you go back to the Cold War period, we had what was called the Kirkpatrick Doctrine after Jeanne Kirkpatrick, who was President Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations. And she had a double standard around human rights where she would vociferously criticize the leftist regimes, the socialist, the communist governments for human rights violations, and you know, really push the United Nations to do something about these violations of human rights. But then for authoritarian dictators like Marcos in the Philippines, Mobutu in Zaire, Somoza in Nicaragua, these were capitalist states. They supported our foreign policy against communism. And so we looked the other way around human rights. And so this double standard weakened our position globally. It continued. Bill Clinton, the Clinton administration, had a double standard where he would criticize the weak countries, but the strong geopolitical countries, economic powerhouses. He tiptoed around China and pushed to get China into the World Trade Organization. And again, so it was a double standard based on the needs of economic globalization and the economic position of the United States. And it continues, you know, during the Bush, George W. Bush administration and the war on terror, we would, you know, you're with us or against us. And so we would overlook the violators of human rights that supported us in the war on terror. And again, this hypocrisy was exposed to the world that we weren't consistent in the application of our human rights values and principles. You know, I think what the case is around U.S. foreign policy is if the United States pits economic concerns or geopolitical interests against human rights, if you pit those against each other and say, well, with this country, you know, with Saudi Arabia, we really need the oil. We really need to have a strong presence in the Middle East through Saudi Arabia. Then human rights will always lose. Or with India, if the policy is around energy or if it's a geopolitical concern, human rights will always lose. And I guess what I believe is that short-sighted, that it comes back to hurt us in the long run and often in the short run, and that we need consistency in the application of these human rights principles, or our reputation suffers, and it has suffered vastly due to this dual standard, this double standard that has just been identified throughout our history, actually, which I think needs to change and can change.
What could change that? Is that just a matter of, I mean, does it come down to who's the president at the time, or, you know, who's pulling the levers on whether or not that can change?
Well, I actually think that the human rights duties flow on three levels. And so I think there's the individual level. I think all of us as citizens of the United States have a duty to educate ourselves, to be aware of sort of the ethical interdependence that exists around the world, and to speak out and vote accordingly and act accordingly. And then second, at the national level, you're right. I think the president makes a big difference, but so does Congress. Jimmy Carter really is the last president who made human rights a priority, and hopefully the new administration will begin to do that. Although I would note that in the debates in the last three presidential elections, human rights, were barely mentioned in the debates between the candidates. But I think there's human rights duties at the nation state level, and then human rights duties at the global level at the UN and that I've already described. And so who would do that? To answer your question, I think in a way, all of us, if we act in the way of, on these three levels, I think it can make a difference. You know, if I think right now, I've mentioned Saudi Arabia, a couple times, and maybe I'm doing that because it's just been in the press lately with the Biden administration releasing the report about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, Turkey, that it was led by the leader of Saudi Arabia, and Biden is going to recalibrate, is the word that he uses, that relationship. I mean, I think that's right, because for years, for decades, actually, the United States has looked the other way around human rights violations inside of Saudi Arabia. We have made other interests, such as trading with Saudi Arabia. They're our largest trading partner in the Middle East. So we export weapons, machinery, vehicles, and billions of dollars, and of course the flow of oil from Saudi Arabia. This has led us to turn the other way, with a blind eye, cover our eyes towards human rights violations. And what has that led to? It's given them the green light to continue violating human rights, and it's spread extremism in the country, and it's led, I think, to a national security concern for us that is produced the elite in Saudi Arabia have protected Wahhabism, which is an ultra-puritanical form of Islam that has been defended by the current rulers. And this has produced individuals who are committed to violent terrorist acts against our country. And so this looking the other way when human rights are violated, it comes back to hurt us from a security point of view as well. And so we need not always prioritize interests over values. Values must be, use that word, recalibrate, that Biden used, recalibrated into a balanced foreign policy.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. William Felice. He's professor of political science at Eckerd College. Dr. Felice is the next featured speaker in the Naples Discussion Group's 2021 schedule. His talk is titled The Ethical Dimensions to International Relations and American Foreign Policy. To engage with us and fellow listeners, find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. How has information technology, social media, the ability to know things that are happening around the world changed the dynamic when it comes to ethics in international relations and foreign policy? It seems like so many more, average everyday citizens are aware of things they wouldn't have been aware of before.
I think it's had a huge impact. I think that in terms of global interdependence that we see in the economic realm, we now see it in the information realm as well. For example, one of the areas that I think is the biggest human rights crisis for the United States, for our country, is the mass incarceration of African Americans in America. And so we have a situation in our country where African Americans make up around 11% of the general adult population, but in federal prisons, they're 50% of state and federal prisons. And if present trends continue, one in three African American men will serve time in prison. There's more Black men in prison today than at any other point in our nation's history. Now, the reason I'm saying this is due to information technology, and your question, due to information technology, those facts that I just read have gone global. And what you see is our citizens in France, citizens around the world, really, in different countries, organizing through NGOs like Amnesty International, non-governmental organizations, to try to pressure their governments to pressure the United States to address mass incarceration of African Americans in the United States. And this is pretty incredible. I think it is kind of like during the Cold War, when many U.S. citizens were concerned about the treatment in the Gulag in the Soviet Union, or the treatment of Jews in the Soviet Union, and pressuring the U.S. government to do something about the treatment of prisoners inside the Soviet Union. You see now, due to social media, people around the world are aware of the treatment of African Americans and the arrests and the incarceration rates, the highest in the world in our country. And so we're getting pressured to change our policies due to, I think, this information technology spreading this information the way I've described. And you could go down a whole list of a new agenda of world politics, you could argue, that has emerged, like gay rights, LGBT rights in Africa. You know, information technology is what has brought the awareness of the violence against the gay community in Africa to the consciousness of sort of people around the world. And so there's pressures now within countries to stop supporting governments that are so repressive to individual rights of the gay community in Africa, and so on. And so it has been, I think, a positive development in that sense to the global human rights movement.
How has it changed how your students approach the subject? Are they more engaged than they would have been a decade or two ago?
I think students are more engaged than a decade or two ago. My students give me great hope. I see them speaking out about all these issues that we've been talking about today, and really trying to craft their intellectual journeys and their life paths to make a difference in the world. And I think that that gives me hope. What I'm a little discouraged about is that I think the students see so many barriers. They look out at the world and they see elites in control of societies and corporate power dominating economics and democracy movements getting squelched. And so I think there is a cynicism about the ability to bring about fundamental change. But with that being said, I do think within that, they really do want to take advantage of this information technology to perhaps craft a new way forward.
You know, this whole notion of international relations is relatively new when it comes to, like, broader human history. How do you see it going in the future? I know that's kind of an impossible question, but, I mean, are we getting collectively better or worse at it in today's world?
I think that what we face are the reality that we have no choice but to get better at it. That if you look at the major security threats to all peoples everywhere, including the United States, such as COVID-19, global pandemic, such as climate change and global warming, such as the global economy now and the way in which we are dependent on inputs and resources from abroad for our economic survival. So from an environmental point of view, from an economic point of view, from a health point of view, from a food production point of view, on and on, we are one small planet. And so what does that mean? It means that I think we have to work harder at building up the international organizations and codifying the international laws that can help us work together to solve this new agenda of world politics. The old realist framework of just focusing on national interests and being just concerned about your citizens' well-being is inoperative in a way, because the national interest now incorporates a global interest. To be a true citizen, a loyal citizen of your country, means at the same time being a world citizen, a global citizen. And so I don't think we have a choice, but I think international relations, global politics is absolutely essential for the survival of humanity and the protection of the national interests of the United States.
Last question. We've only got a couple minutes, so I'm going to really put you on the spot here. But back at the beginning, we talked about how, you know, you had the three prongs. You said we have norms that have been established that, you know, countries try to follow. I forget where the second one was, but then the third one was enforcement.
Institutions.
And so the enforcement, what is the, you know, what could break the logjam when it comes to enforcement in the United Nations?
I think that it depends on issue by issue, in a sense, that you can reach a consensus perhaps on a particular issue. But I do think enforcement depends upon listening to the victims and the voices of the oppressed. And so maybe an example could clarify this. One area where human rights activism and global pressure worked was, I think, in fighting against apartheid in South Africa. Why did that work? It was an inside-outside approach of enforcement that the ANC asked for help, asked for sanctions, and so the leadership came from inside that country. It wasn't imposed from outside. And so if we listen to the leadership of those fighting to protect their rights in Myanmar, in China, and take their in Saudi Arabia, and the women in Saudi Arabia, and take the leadership from them and not try to impose it from the outside, then perhaps that logjam you described can be overcome.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have. I'm sure we could talk about this for at least another hour or two, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. William Felice, is professor of political science at Eckerd College. Dr. Felice, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Felice previously served as a representative to the United Nations for a human rights non-governmental organization. He's the author of 6 books, Introduction to International Politics, Global Challenges and Policy Responses, Taking Suffering Seriously, The Ethics of Interdependence, Global Human Rights and Duties, The Global New Deal, and How Do I Save My Honor? He's the next featured speaker in the Naples Discussion Group's 2021 schedule, which is not open to the public this year. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/gcl, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is NPR for Southwest Florida, 90.1 WGCU FM, Fort Myers, Naples, and Punta Gorda, and 91.7 WMKO Marco Island. We're a member-supported service of Florida Gulf Coast University. Thank you.